to the chase, okay? What are you guys selling?
Well, welcome back to Section Jacks. I'm Tom Alley. Mr. Tina on the board.
Yes. Good.
Giving me the weather in New York before he even gives the weather on Stacks and Jacks. That's how up the man is. On the
I'm ready to go.
Ready to go. S&P futures up 7, NASDAQ futures up 29, Dow futures up 57. We kind of faded into the close a little bit yesterday, and you can't do that. Come on. We got to go up every day. We got to make sure that the money in Afghanistan that we left over there is that's worthless. We've got to. Kind of crazy stuff. All I'm thinking about is why would we want our dollar to be worth less, guys? And I'm thinking of all these different reasons. But anyway, Lou, how are you, buddy?
Good morning, sir. I saw those pictures of New York last night, and I asked myself, how much rain did they get, and how much damage has been done? It looked like the whole subway system was flooding.
Well, that would not be good. I'll answer.
I don't know if you saw the pictures, but I mean, in Brooklyn and Hoboken, and I think Lower Manhattan, the water was up to the the door handles on cars.
Is Hoboken anywhere near Hoboken?
Pardon me.
Is Hoboken anywhere near Hoboken?
Hoboken, yeah, whatever it is. I don't know how we're going to call it.
A typical guy who grew up in Canada, Hoboken,
whatever. Emphasis on the hobo.
Yeah.
I watched that video last night, and we were showing each other video on our phones as we were getting ready to go to bed, and I told my wife this is a disaster.
Yeah,
and I heard somebody this morning make a comment that for the last basically the last 6 years or 5 years it's just been Orange Man Bad by de Blasio and. In Como, and they haven't really focused on the desperate need for infrastructure repair in New York City, and I would guess that this is part of it, but I don't know until I hear something report on how much rain they got. Do you have any idea?
Yes, as a matter of fact, it was one of the quickest records to be broken. They had some storm there. I'm going to say within the last month. David could probably find it. And they had the greatest rainfall in 1 hour ever in Central Park since they've been hanging out.
I remember that thunderstorm. Okay,
and that was like maybe 3-4 weeks ago. It was 2-point-something inches in an hour in Central Park, which is pretty much like being in your shower, I think. Well, they broke that last night. They shattered it last night with 3.1 in an hour. That's coming pretty fast, though. Really, no place for that to run.
Yeah, I remember looking at weather graph site when I lived in LaGrange, and remember seeing that that LaGrange at one point got a little over four inches in an hour during one of those massive storms coming through, and of course that flooded everything.
Yeah,
streets and basements and the whole bit. But New York has such an extensive underground infrastructure. I watched that water pouring into the subways, and I was thinking, surely they have some kind of more effective draining system than this.
Well, you'd have to pump it. You'd have to pump it out.
Well, right. Yeah, there'd have to be some way of pulling it out, or you build a subsystem of tunnels below the subway. But holy cow, that was unbelievable.
For those that I was going to say landlubbers for people who aren't on the ships, but if you aren't familiar with New York, it is the subway system. Don't get me started. I could talk for an hour and a half on the subway system, but it's not like Chicago.
Too late.
Well, yeah, it's too late. It's not like Chicago where you have essentially tubes underground where the subway runs, and hence the name subway. New York, it's essentially a full railroad system underground. With sidetracking and shifting areas, and where there might some spots there's 4 or 5 tracks next to each other, the express and the local, and if you go I believe the 37th Street station, 3 subways come into each other, and they're on 3 different levels. So if you want to get to whatever the lowest one is and go wherever the hell that goes, you're essentially talking what, 8, 10 flights of stairs, David, something like that? And you grind up from the bottom. This is not for the handicapped. This is not for the fatsoes. This is not for the people who haven't worked out in a month. It's a long slug from that bottom one. You go up the steps thinking you're getting to the ground. You're getting to the next subway line. And then you go up again and you get another subway line. Finally, then you reach air. And I don't see how the hell, well, without a huge pumping system, that if water gets to that lower level, you're getting the hell out of there. But just to give you an idea, Lou, of how water can work, and I'm no geologist or anything like that, but the Chicago area, I've read pretty extensively on essentially the development of the city. And the development of Chicago is really the evolution of water management. Because
the city was built in the swamp.
Right, and you had so many people, and because of the stackyards, because of the tanneries, it's at one point there were 300,000 people in Chicago, and there was more essentially sewage, poop, whatever you want to call it, than any city in the world, including London. And London at the time had over 3 million people, so it was all about water getting here, sewage getting out, and. One thing I read was
that's the basis for the sanitary canal being built, right?
Oh, sure.
Was to take the sewage and let's call it black water from Chicago and push it down to the Mississippi River to keep it from flowing into Lake Michigan.
Right, and the idea is dilution.
Where it needs to go, where it belongs, to St. Louis.
Well, by the time it gets to St. Louis, it's pretty much clean.
Or Iowa.
No, it's pretty much clean. Dilution. And there are helping us out, there are zillions of little bacterias that love to eat what we don't want to eat. And it doesn't take all that long between dilution and bacterial effects for the water to be reasonably clean. Anyway, but the point I'm talking about is when you talk about rains like you're saying, in Chicago, because it's a certain amount of topsoil on top of clay, which is a totally different topography than New York. New York is all on rock. I mean, you see rocks sticking out in the parks. I mean, Manhattan Island is basically a big rock. I mean, hence the name. What do they call it? The Big Rock or something? But when you get the first 2 inches of rain in Chicago, according to this one of the books I was reading, actually two of them, the first 2 inches of rain pretty much are absorbed on the spot, Lou. But there's enough black dirt and other kind of dirt to absorb it right kind of where it is. The next 2 inches, 95% of it runs toward the little rivers we have. So it's a huge difference between whether you get 2 inches of rain or three or more. And I gotta believe in New York, it's the same thing. I mean, I'm sure they can handle one and a half, maybe two without even blinking. Two and a half, you know, three and a half, four, I think you got a real problem.
I think one of the things that jumps out at us because of, climate change or however you want to characterize it, is that we are getting more severe or more significant weather events than we've seen recently. You know, we've seen in the last 50 years. I mean, I remember distinctly living in Chicago and seeing, you know, two 100-year rains in the space of about 10 years.
Well, some of that...
What about the deep tunnel system? I mean, the deep tunnel system. Chicago spent, a couple of billion digging out tunnels to flow into old quarries to be able to hold water. Has that ever functioned?
Lou, first of all, let me give you a little education on the deep tunnel. Again, it's very rare that I have actually read more on a subject than you have. You realize how rare this is?
That's why I'm asking you these questions.
I'm going to say that you know me. I'm not a spring chicken anymore. I'm going to say, David, that the deep tunnel started when we were in high school. Am I correct?
I will look that up.
And it has been an absolute two or three generation boom for Kenny Construction. It has been ongoing. I think it's somewhat done, Lou, because the tunnels were done a while ago. The problem was, where are you actually going to put it? The tunnels were probably done 15, 20 years ago. The problem is they could never find a reservoir. And I think they ended up using McCook Quarry, and I think that...
Yeah.
And I think that is now complete, or if it isn't, it's real close. Because the object is, the tunnel system, if we got like 2 inches of rain, would fill up in a second. It would help a little bit. But of course, in the meantime, you had more and more areas that were paved over. So you were essentially, fighting a battle where the lines kept shifting.
Well, I mean, first of all, it's because you can't compress water.
No.
The even if you've got the ultimate exit point, the key is the entrance points. How
right.
narrow are the entrance points, and how wide is the tunnel carrying the water into McCook? I thought McCook Quarry is a huge place, and my understanding was it was holding like, you know, 5 or 6 quadrillion gallons
oh, yeah.
or something like that.
Yeah. So the phase one, I'm sorry, Lou, I didn't mean to interrupt. Phase one of the tunnel system began in 1975.
Right, so we were a little past high school. But still a while ago.
That's amazing.
Yeah, and but Lou, I think what happens is if you just little stuff that you know the listeners, because I don't want you to turn into me and see all this stuff. If you go buy like a new Walmart, when I say new, somewhere in the last, you know, 15, 20 years, built someplace, go buy it after a heavy rain. And what you'll see is the parking lot is not flat. You'll see that it's actually pitched into areas where there is essentially sewer drains in the bottom of what would be the drain. And if you go by after a heavy rain, you'll see that those lots are all flooded. And they're done that on purpose. And the idea is if you build a big place, I'm going to say in the last 25 years, David, you have to have the ability to retain the water that lands on your place on the property, at least for a while. I don't know how long it is. And when they redid up by you, I used to live, Glen Ellen, the golf course, the really nice golf course out there. What the hell's the name of it? The Lynx? Village Lynx or something?
I don't know. Golf is a game for old people.
Oh, God. Well, we're getting there. when they rebuilt it, there was like a little bit of a, I won't use the term canyon, but there was a real low area where the creek went through there. And they, because as part of the rebuild, the county or somebody, the sanitary district, gave those guys a bunch of money to widen out and they could actually use that as a reservoir if needed for like a real lot of water. So they actually put a dam there where they could stop up that stream and hold a lot of water there. And so there's been a lot of stuff that's going on in the area that you don't even really, way back in the day, the Des Plaines River used to be further east and they moved it west in some areas, like in Riverside and those areas. It used to be this way because, those that maybe don't know, there's two watersheds here that you can't even see the dividing line, which happens to be like in Summit in that area, right along Harlem Avenue. The Des Plaines River area goes to Lake Michigan, and the Chicago River area used to flow into Lake Michigan. I'm sorry, the Des Plaines went to New Orleans. But first, when they talk about big floods in Chicago that caused cholera and all that stuff, what actually happened, Lou, is the Des Plaines River would overflow into the Chicago River drainage and cause the Chicago River to race into the lake with huge volume, pushing all the crap, and I use that term loosely, into the lake that would cause all the problems. It wasn't just the Chicago River flooded and went into the lake. The Des Plaines, it would get water from the Des Plaines as well. So the first thing they did was move the Des Plaines further away from the Chicago Rivershed. Watershed.
Yeah.
There's been a real lot of stuff that's happened.
I mean, it's one of the things that I've seen about that Chicago should be undertaking, if it's not, and I assume this is being done in certain places, is the use of water permeable paving that allows that topsoil, rather than just having runoff, that allows the topsoil to absorb as much of the water as possible. I'm waiting, Chief, for the project, and we've actually talked about this before. I'm waiting for the project that involves building a hydro pipeline from the Midwest, which is getting lots more moisture, out to the West, which desperately needs it, and figuring out some way to put, you know, a large scale pipeline that would just run continuously, because there's so much water that is needed, but that would run from, I don't know, someplace near the Great Lakes, and siphon off watershed as the, you know, the Mississippi starts to flood or whatever, and just pump that directly across, you know, the Midwest, with maybe outlying stations for irrigation, but into Denver, into the Front Range here, that it could be then distributed into the water system for the west. They're having real problems west of me, and when we talk about water a lot on the show because I'm in Denver, but there's a severe drought and a severe shortage for water going from the Colorado River into the two big reservoirs in Nevada, and you know this year was the first year that they started rationing water and forever it starts in Arizona and Nevada. Eventually it'll get to the point where they're rationing water in California, and if they shut down the Central Valley or start limiting the ability to grow crops in the richest crop growing area in the country, and that's the Central Valley of California, they start shutting that down, things will get really interesting here in terms of groceries and in terms of access to stuff that we've just presumed for decades.
David, it should be you or me to tell Lou if he wants our water, he should move back here.
Well, no. That may happen, that there may be a population shift back to the Midwest because of water.
Lou, my grandfather was an odd duck in many ways. I won't go into it, but one of the things he did was take the train out to California, like in the 50s, because he worked on the railroad as a boilermaker, so I think he didn't have to pay for the ticket. He was out there a few weeks because he thought maybe he wanted to move the family to California, and he came back and he said, they're going to have water problems out there. We're not moving. That was in the 50s. But my question to you is, it actually makes some sort of sense. When you look at there was no Stevenson Expressway, right? So nobody really lived southwest of the city. Okay, so you build the Stevenson Expressway, I think it probably had 2 or 3 lanes when it started. And all of a sudden, all these people move out there. So immediately the Stevenson gets jammed, and so you add a lane, and it's jammed again as more and more people move out there. At some point, I'm going to say that the water situation, Phoenix, if you look at the Teddy Roosevelt Dam and those places, probably has the ability to have, what would you guess, 500,000 people? From the water that lands around Phoenix, and the big fight.
I don't have any way of estimating that. I will say that in California, especially, you see the collision of ideological idiocy with reality, and for decades, people in California who have looked at this water situation have said we need to start thinking about desalinization plants. We need to look toward nations like Israel, where they have a desert, basically a desert geography, and yet have been able to provide enough water for population growth because they've developed desalinization technology, and we need to start doing that. And for every time one of those facilities starts, the discussion starts for one of those facilities, the ideological voting bloc that runs California, the elect, says no, because environmentally there might be problems. And my response to that is, well, in that case, then A, burn up, because you don't have enough water to irrigate your landscaping and everything else that will prevent forest fires. B, dry up, because you don't have enough water now, or you will ultimately not have enough water to irrigate crops and sustain your economy, and you're going to be in a situation where, again, infrastructure. These are the kinds of things that governments used to worry about and work on developing.
Well, we don't do that anymore. We argue and we take money and we give it to our friends. That's all we do. That's right.
The money goes to a $4 billion train system that ultimately, there was no economic justification for, that ultimately flops. It goes somewhere other than, for example, upkeep on the Oroville Dam. There hasn't been a dam improvement project in California, I think, for like 2 generations.
Right.
Because the environmental mentality and the movement in California has effectively blocked it.
But Lou, there's
And this is what they're living with now.
But I'm looking at for those that don't, you live in the Chicago area, you live someplace in the Northeast or wherever, well, especially Northeast, now you got a lot of water. But when you look at water in Chicago, you're pretty much arguing with your neighbor if you argue at all. But when there's water problems in the West, Phoenix is arguing with Denver over Colorado River water. So who can have more people? Who can build the most? So the water from Phoenix comes from Colorado and Utah. It comes from Lake Mead, or the one below that.
Powell.
Lake Powell, which essentially comes out of the Chicago or the Colorado River Basin. So the fight is between how much water of that really starts in Colorado, where in Illinois we would have no problem saying Lake Michigan's our water, screw you guys. Over a long period of time, and the power of politics and the federal government getting involved, that water is portioned out to California, Arizona. So literally, a fight about Arizona water has to do with, they're fighting with Denver. And they actually got a second canal from the dam into Phoenix, how many years ago? 15, 20 years ago? So in essence, Phoenix is growing using what most people would think is Colorado's water, if there is such a thing as owning water. And Denver is sort of struggling. So at some point, you sort of agree that somebody's got to make the decision, but you really would never think that Phoenix is an area that's going to have, what are they up to? Well, look at the population of Phoenix, will you, David? I got to believe they're up to 2 million people, or damn near. Now, there's no way on earth that somebody like me who's looking at it from the outside, and I could care less about who gets what water, other than let it be just, you can't let Phoenix be 5 million people. I mean, and there's zero regard to the water when you build. I got to believe it for a decade, it was the fastest growing city in the country. I mean, so somewhere, someplace, you can't say, hey, we've got a problem, you guys got to fix it. Give us your water.
Yeah, well, and this, you know, I mean, economically, and I think I've talked about this on the show before, economically, there are fixes. And some fairly creative ones. So, for example, Denver, I have yet to see an intelligent discussion by the Denver city government, which I consider to be run by people who are way overmatched with sort of basic governance. I've yet to see a discussion by the Denver city government about this water, at least publicly. I'm sure it gets kicked around privately. But for example, one of the things that is being done to pull water into the Denver metro area is to reach into the mines, the hundreds and hundreds of miles of mines that are in the mountains west of Denver, up by Frisco and Breckenridge and Vail and Aspen and Leadville. And, you know, those mines fill up every year with water, runoff from the mountains that basically doesn't get captured any other way. Those mines fill up. I have represented a company that takes that water and is able to chemically treat it and then pump it out of those mines. And you're talking about, you know, 100,000, 200,000, 300,000 acre feet of water coming out of that area. It replenishes naturally, they pump it because of the way Denver draws its water. They don't have to pump it very far. It only has to get pumped, I think, about, you know, maybe 10 miles before it hits the first reservoir of the Denver system. But once it gets into that system, it's all fungible. But it's treated, and that's a fairly creative way of adding water into your system that you would normally be lost. I just think we're going to, given the expansion in the West, given the fact that people are fleeing, you know, California and some other places to get out here and Illinois and the Midwest, I just think that there's going to have to be some kind of effective water transfer. Somebody's going to be talking about it eventually. I know water is more, its use rate is such that you would need a monster pipeline to put a dent in our problem here, but I think there's going to be some kind of solution.
So you think that
based on just the economics.
So you think if 15 million people want to live in Phoenix, they can just ignore the problem and run around trying to steal somebody else's?
Well, I mean, Arizona is number one. The Colorado River folks that
1 minute
Colorado River pack that goes back to the 1920s. There's an increasing series of cutoffs based on who had first shot at the water. You know, Colorado's got first shot at the water, and then California, and then I think parts of Nevada, and then I think Arizona. So the turnoff, the spigots turn off for people first in Arizona. And in fact, one of the things that's happening here in Colorado is water or metropolitan entities in Arizona and Nevada are paying farmers in Colorado not to water their fields.
Lou,
they
are
buying those water rights from those folks so that more water will be available for the people downstream.
Lou, I think it has to do with the individual reservoir and which one has the water, because Vegas has had to cut back because Lake Mead's getting so low that the intake pipes. It has to do with which reservoir gets filled first or is allowed to go down first. And it's a complicated system.
All of that is driven by this set of priorities that comes off the river pack.
Right. And funny. I think you guys cheat when I say you guys Colorado. There's a little reservoir just south of one direction. Maybe it's one way. It's across the divide from Breckenridge, so it has to be.
That's Frisco.
No, the other way.
It's a Dillon Reservoir.
I know, but keep going through Breckenridge and keep driving on that road, and you go up through this total squirrely pass and down into a, there's another reservoir.
Hoosier Pass, and then it's the Antero Reservoir in that area.
Well, we went, it was a little tiny one, and we went fishing, years ago. Of course, we didn't catch any fish. My guys had worms and all that, and the fish are walking right by, you know, laughing at our worms. But there, all of a sudden, I'm going, what's that noise? And I walked over to the other side, and there was this big hole in the divide. And they cut a hole in the divide, and water was gushing through from the other side. You were stealing it from the other guys. You were stealing it from the Colorado water and pushing it into the Denver side reservoir.
Well, that's true throughout this area. In fact, one of the ironies about the way the weather has developed is the Front Range, Denver, the reservoirs that supply Denver, and especially the reservoirs on the east side of the Front Range of the Rocky Mountains, are all full right now because we've had lots of rain.
Really?
And the weather system is we had a very wet, month. We had kind of a drought last summer, but the most of Colorado right now is out of drought. It wasn't severe drought.
All right, Lou, we gotta go out of show into break. How's that? Out of drought.
Fair enough.
S&P futures up 8 and NASDAQ's up 40. Be right back. Stacks and Jacks.
How much confidence do you have that your investments will make you wealthy? Do you truly know the odds? Welcome to Luckbox, the control freak's guide to life, money, and probability. Luckbox shows you how to gauge the likelihood of success before you commit to an investment or any other decision. And Luckbox is free for 1 year at luckboxmagazine.com/jocks. Each new issue dives deep into the current investing climate, separates the signal from the noise with relevant trade ideas, and equips you with cutting-edge tactics you don't already know. Luckbox is the essential magazine for proactive investors who are hell-bent on pursuing life, luxury, and happiness through sports, fitness, travel, food, spirits, music, and a whole lot more. Smart investors don't bet on possibilities, they play the probabilities. Luckbox is $7.99 on newsstands, but you can subscribe for 10 free digital issues at luckboxmagazine.com/jocks. Don't rely on luck. Get Luckbox at luckboxmagazine.com/jocks.
Hello, this is Tom Howell, the Chief. Confused about investing these days? I suspect you are not alone. Investing was never easy, although at times it may have seemed so. I think one reason behind the current concern, although maybe not explained as such, is how the fluctuation in the American dollar and the associated politics is affecting your investments and your wealth. It may not be enough to make some money in your investments. You may need now to make enough to exceed the amount that your leadership is depreciating the value of the dollars you've worked your whole life to accumulate. That same leadership has seen fit to maneuver risk-free interest rates to near zero. Providing positive risk-averse returns in a zero-interest and declining real wealth environment is by far the toughest assignment I've ever had in my years as a money manager. I'm sure that a lot of you have heard that one way to possibly deal with this problem is to invest in so-called hard currencies like silver and gold, the idea being that they will retain their relative value in the face of devaluation of paper currencies like the dollar. To be honest, I have never been a gold bug. I've always had faith that having enough dollars and a good investment strategy was good enough. Now I'm not so sure. but I do know that if I did invest in gold or silver, I'd want to do it in the same manner as we do with PTI for investments in the market, with defined risk. If you feel the need to invest in gold or silver, we can do it using the same strategies that we use for our protected index program. No matter what you invest in, we feel that you need to know and control your risk. Find us at PTISecurities.com, that's PTISecurities.com.
Is your business being challenged by the complexities surrounding healthcare reform or other matters related to human resources management? If so, then Cognos HR can help. A longtime friend and contributor to the Socks and Jocks radio program, Cognos HR provides its clients with a perfect blend of strategic consulting and day-to-day HR management to drive overall improvement in business performance. Companies that join the Cognos HR family are better able to manage healthcare costs, enhance benefit offerings, and improve employee satisfaction by leveraging our access to Fortune 500 benefits. Our innovative onboarding and payroll technology, along with our constant attention to detail, enables us to provide the highest level of quality service to our clients. Now, your time and energy can be focused on generating business and increasing your bottom line. We'll take care of the rest. For more information, call us at 630-401-8810 or search us on the web at CognosHR.com. Cognos HR, innovation in human resources. Licensed in Illinois and Arizona.
Stocks, jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now, right here, right now, right now.
Hello and welcome to Stocks and Jocks. I'm Tom Howell. Dave Scantino on the board. He's pouring, Lou, he's pouring over weather maps here, trying to figure out where the storm's going, why they didn't get so much rain in Tennessee. He's got it racing through Tennessee. The guy's on fire over there. What can I tell you? Just saying. The S&P futures are up 875. I'm looking here for the latest on the jobs. They're supposed to be 943. No, we're supposed to be 720. And we're supposed to be 5.2 on the rate tomorrow. So that's where we're headed on the jobs numbers. So we're kind of ahead of these jobs numbers. Yesterday they were surprised at the downside on the ADP number, which, you know, sometimes matches up with the others, sometimes does not. So we have, let me get the other page back up here. Okay, Dow futures up 45. Individual stocks in the Dow, we've got Apple up 96 cents. Apple's been pretty, going up the last couple days. I mean, it's just one of those weeks where, even though I'd be very reluctant to trade on calendar these days. It's a slow week. And I've always thought since I was in the business, and Dave may agree with me that, or disagree, that whatever happens to the market on really slow days when nobody really has an edge one way or the other, or certainly an opinion, is kind of the direction the market's heading. And I think in this day and age, the Fed doing what they're doing, every time we see a real slow day, we just kind of creep up. Now, yesterday we actually sold off into the close a little bit, but still we're up. Matter of fact, the review of yesterday, Dow ended up being down 48, but S&P was up a buck, and NASDAQ was up 50. So the NASDAQ is pushing ahead now as people are going back to the COVID stock. You're seeing the Amazons go up in those kinds of places. So we're kind of flashing back and over in those areas, whether we should be or not, you know, who knows. DAX up 32 cents. Let's call that one flat. FTSE down 5. Call that one flat. Ekron up 2. Call that flat. So this is probably the last week of whatever it is they do over in Europe regarding vacations. David, is it, you're more of a traveler than me, or Lou, is it the last week? Is this week considered an August week or just September week when those guys
this
do their
This is an August week. This is one of the biggest vacation weeks of the year.
For in Europe and here.
And here, yes.
Okay. Nikkei up 92 points, 0.3%. Shanghai up 29.8. Hang Seng up 62.2%. So they've recovered somewhat from pretty much. I think Hang Seng's probably almost back up to where it was, even after being down 20% at one point. The bonds, we are 1.29, so that's pretty much unchanged. The Bund, minus 0.39, that's minus 1 basis point. Japan, positive 0.03, that's unchanged. So there's not much going on in the bond pit. Oil up 42 cents, 69.01, trying to get back over 70, which it was a few weeks ago. Brent up 49 cents, 72.08. Natural gas up another 4 cents to 466. RBOB up a penny to 212. We have gold is up 10 cents to 1816, so it's kind of quiet around this 1810, 1815 number here. Silver down 3 cents, 2418. Copper unchanged at 428. And we have Bitcoin up 1700 to 49,977, trying to go over 50,000 again. It's turned into a stock with no value. But then again, David, most of the other stocks, a lot of the other stocks trading real high don't have any value either. So what's the difference?
Right.
What do you got for us, Traffic Weather Sports?
6:38 in Chicago. Currently, the weather is 68 and partly cloudy. We're going to hit a high of 76. Beautiful day with suns and clouds. For our Phoenix listeners, 77 and, yes, light rain. They actually have a flood advisory. It's going to be 97.
Phoenix is getting nothing but water. The whole Phoenix area, we have a listener from Phoenix that once in a while sends me a...
Right.
There's
a hurricane that came through, guys.
Yeah.
Well, they also had a bunch of gully washers before this where they had, wind damage. This is their wet season. But the interesting part, Lou, as you were talking about, the western part of the state has gotten nothing. The western part of Arizona and the eastern part of California is where the severe drought is, and they've gotten zero. But everything from Phoenix east is way out of drought, I think, at this point. So, I mean, it's not that far away where there's still severe versus no problem. It's been happening all around the country. It's kind of crazy. Go ahead, David. Sorry.
That's okay. For the high in Phoenix today, it's going to be 97, partly cloudy. Sports, baseball last night, the Cubs beat the Twins 3-0. Sox win, beating the Pirates 6-3, and Diamondbacks take out the Padres 8-3. FedEx Cup playoffs conclude this week with the Tour Championship at the East Lake Golf Club in Atlanta, Georgia, and a full slate of college football this weekend with the Chiefs Fighting Irish taking on Florida State Sunday night at 6:30. Back to you.
I was all set to figure out who I was going to watch it with and where I was going to be Saturday night, and all of a sudden I'm going, oops, it's Sunday.
Yes, it is.
That would have been interesting to have a football party on Saturday with no game.
There's a lot of football on Saturday.
What's the discussion going on right now in Chicago about the Fields, Dalton, the quarterback starting situation?
Well, Fields is the most popular man in town, as the second string quarterback in Chicago always is.
Yep. That is a fact.
Do you guys? I watched a little bit of Fields. Do you guys think that the Bears' offensive line is sufficiently strong to avoid the Jay Cutler problem?
Yep.
Him getting just beaten into the ground the first four or five games he gets out there.
Lou, we just got a left tackle who's 39 years old. They're often these quarterbacks are going to get killed.
Well, the guys in the middle, and you can maybe talk to this a little bit, Lou. The guy in the center is from Notre Dame. When he was there, he was real good on an offensive line that was extraordinary. The guy didn't even get drafted. So somehow he wanders into the Bears camp, or his agent brought him there. And the guy who was playing center, was it Cody Whitehair or something? Who's actually a natural guard, I believe, out of Iowa.
They moved. I saw that they moved him there. That's the kind of flexibility you typically see in offensive lines.
But he's a serious guy. I mean, he's not on a scale. I mean, you see the thing now when I introduce the people in their, I don't know if it's new this year or just new to me. Whoever station I was watching, who's Thursday Night Football? Anyway, I was watching. They introduce the offensive line, and they'll have, like, Lou Michaels, and then they'll have 5 out of 125, which will be, out of the 125 guards there are playing, he's fifth best or something. So they'll put some guy up there, and he's, like, 110th out of 125, which doesn't look so good for you. But the Cleveland guys, like, three of their offensive linemen were in the top five of their position.
I'm just going to tell you, this is, and we've talked about this, to the extent that you are putting rookie quarterbacks in play here, the offensive line is the most important thing you have on the team as a group. They, at least for the ability to do anything offensively. And I remember watching Cutler, when he was playing for the Bears, and thinking to myself, if they give this kid time, he will pick you apart. And I watched games where he did that, where they were able to protect him, and he cut people to ribbons with his passing. This kid, Fields, looks like he has that kind of capability, but plus he can run. But my concern with him, I'm not so much concerned about the guy in New England, because Belichick understands this, but the idea that we're going to start, the kid for the Jets, I look at these teams and say, if you can't protect these guys, you're gonna end up with like you did with Joe Burrow. I mean, they'll look good for five or six games, and then they're gonna get broken. And my immediate reaction on Fields is, do you have the wherewithal to put to put in front of this kid so that he will have time to make the decisions until the game slows down a little bit for him?
Well,
or is he just going to get beaten to, pounded into the turf?
Well, I'm not a massive Bear fan. Plus,
that's why we have Andy Dalton. He's going to take the beating first.
Yeah,
he's going to take the beating first. Well, I mean, Dalton at least has showed that, Dalton, with an experienced quarterback, you get the understanding that the pocket collapses quick. He can get rid of the ball or he'll eat the ball. He won't be making the bad judgments that a new player typically does. But I see the pressure to start Fields. My immediate reaction is to say, get your offensive line stabilized first. Get that ballet among those five guys working, that dance troupe that is the offensive line, get them working together, and then you put this kid in.
Well, Lou, I would say
the thing I thought was really interesting is it looked like the Bears were literally trying to establish a running game.
Yeah, well, the three guys in the middle of the line, I think, are very solid. The kid from Notre Dame, this white hair, and whoever the other guard was, because he was sick. He was hurt last year. They're solid. The Bears, of course, move up to get Fields, right? So they grab a tackle in what, the second or third round. They think the guy's going to start first day. How many left tackles start that you draft in the second or third round first day? So the guy gets here, and I guess he was rumored to be injured in college. The Bears thought he was okay. The guy's already had back surgery. If he plays at all this year, the Bears draft a guy with back problems at the tackle position, like the kid from Texas. What was his name?
We had Chris Williams. There was a lot of them. Yeah. The Bears, they have a record of getting linemen that were injured prior to coming into the NFL.
Yeah, so he's out. So, like David said, they went and got this guy who's 39 years old. It was an all-pro, but he's having trouble staying healthy. I don't even know who the right tackle is. So right now you have three interior linemen that are certainly decent, if not better than decent. And you've got two tackles that maybe Dave's going to get the call. We'll see.
For pass protection, if you can identify this stuff, you use your backs or your tight end to assist with pro, so that you get 6-on-4 or 6-on-5. But if you're not doing that, and if you're trying to put the offensive coordinator's thought process always goes to the passing game, because that's where they can look like geniuses. And so you're always trying to get as many guys out into the pattern as you can. And this, again, is where I thought Cutler was remarkable with what he did, because Jay did not need a lot of guys out in the pattern because he was such an accurate thrower. I don't know if Fields is that accurate, but to the extent that you want to put a lot of people out in the pattern so that you open up passing lane to your quarterback, you reduce the pass blocking effectiveness, especially if you've got weak spots on the line. And so that balance has got to be there. And I didn't see enough of Fields playing during the preseason, and so I can't really tell you whether he whether the Bears figured out that balance or got that balance determined. I thought it was really interesting for them to have a quarterback like Fields and yet at the same time be pushing to get a decent run game going, and it looks like they can run the football.
Well, they got a couple guys they can run, but I did a short stint, very short stint, Lou, as a sort of an offensive coordinator for a really good touch football league. And to me, I know that these guys know way more than I ever, whatever. But it seemed very simple to me in the sense that if you only have three people in the pattern and there's five deep backs, if a linebacker drops off, you better have somebody that's like really, really good, because you're overwhelmed. It's all about, this better than anybody, that if you have a guard that can handle his guy and you don't have to worry about, now it becomes 4-on-3 for the other guys, right? And all of a sudden it makes it a lot easier. If you have two linemen that are standout, now it becomes 3-on-2 and you can pretty much handle anybody. It's all about, if you can get
Sure, it's about matchups.
But if the Bears, if you keep six people in, you're not going to have that short, what do you want to call the guy who runs around in the 10 or 12 yard area that Belichick seems to always have that drives the other team bananas, because you get the deep guys covered and the guys going down the field because this guy seems to know where all the Edelman or whoever he gets, it's always a guy that seems to know exactly where the weak spots in the zone are. Well, if that guy's not in the pattern because he's blocking somebody, you got a real problem because you know,
and that's my question. I mean, I always thought that Cutler was one of those guys that, you know, you could have two guys out running patterns, and Cutler could get the ball to him, because no matter how many guys you've got, you know, out there on defense in zone or even man to man, the matchup is almost always going to be, at least initially, the matchup is almost always going to be one on one, at least for the first 5 to 10 yards. And if you can get the ball in there, then you can do some damage. I would expect to see, you know, three guys out in the pattern would be the minimum.
Well, Louis, I mean, you know,
if they can't get people moved around on that line fast enough to cover for the weak guy, then they're going to have to keep people in. But, and that's just the way it's going to be for him for a while.
We also have Nagy calling play, so that's kind of not.
Oh yeah, we have that. That's a plus. But Lou, you look at your tight end position. Everybody says, "Oh wow, wouldn't you like to have a guy like Olsen, who the Bears eventually got rid of for a bag of balls?" Olsen has his type, which is not a disparaging thing. The guy's probably going to go to the Hall of Fame, for God's sake. He and his type, they want to line up 5 feet outside the tackle, 5 yards maybe if they can, and they want to get in the pattern. And a good tight end in the pattern drives your defensive backfield bananas. Because here's another guy, and by the way, he's a real big guy. The only guy who can really probably cover him physically is a strong safety, who usually is helping out with other people. If all of a sudden that guy has to stay in because the tackle sucks, it's a whole different world for the defensive coordinator, in a much easier world.
Right. So what you do in a situation like that is you have the tight end, for example, not block 100%. In other words, ball snapped, he and that tackle both block the defensive end or linebacker together, and then the tight end releases.
Or,
you know, it's called a chip, and they chip the guy. That may be all they need to be able to control that guy, rather than keeping the tight end in to block.
But in any
the backs
given,
are typically in there to pick up blitzes.
But any given play, you can tell your defensive end, nail the chipper guy. Don't let him in the pattern. Don't let him disengage, and you can disturb the pattern.
You can try. It's almost impossible to do that when you've got two people blocking you. Trust me.
Well, some tight ends like Ditka, well, man, that's why he's in the Hall of Fame. Ditka they'd have somebody on him on the line, and he was tough enough to shed that guy and still get in the pattern. But not all of them can.
Right. Right. No, I agree. But you know, if he comes down on that defensive end, if your tight end comes down on that defensive end and then releases, I mean, it may hang him up, because the linebacker that typically picks up the tight end on a play like that has the option or the opportunity to jam the tight end in on the block rather than having the guy release outside. That's just something you have to develop. And one of the things you do in a situation like that is you give that linebacker who's supposed to be jamming the tight end, you give him a key on offense that says, hey, the play's coming outside, so that he doesn't close down on your tight end and crunch it into the pile. There are a number of ways of playing this, but my point is just, if to the extent you're going to put Fields in there, you and you want him to be effective, I think you're going to have to really make some adjustments on the line, or you're going to have a really good offensive line. And I just don't know if the Bears have it. If they can get a run game going, that will help take the pressure off of Fields, because your defensive people will be a little more honest. But I just don't know if that's in there. Denver, which does not have a good quarterback situation right now, is I think trying to get their line built back up. They had a terrible line last year. They're trying to get their line built back up so that they can run the football again. And that, which I find remarkable, because that used to be the hallmark on the Elway teams. That was the hallmark of Denver football.
Right.
They had a really good offensive line that run blocked as well as pass blocked well. You go back to my father and his thought process on offensive line play, and he always believed that to make a good pass blocking offensive line, you established a run game first. And if you had your people able to block for running, and he said run blocking is much harder than pass blocking.
Well, that's why he was hired by Bud Grant, not Eric Coryell.
Well, that's right. But his thought process was, if I can get a line that run blocks well, and we are not afraid to establish a run blocking mentality with our offensive line, our passing game will get easier.
I think it will.
In terms of protection.
Hey, Luke, can I change? I know you love football, and so do I, but a lot of listeners do. What is the economic ramifications, investment ramifications, if any, going forward from this? I won't say fiasco, but the Afghanistan situation. I mean, we seem to have left some money, some equipment. I don't know how valuable it has to be replaced. I don't know how old it was. I mean, what do you see? Is there anything going forward that you're worried about because of that? I mean, is there anything over there that if the Chinese or the Russians getting Dutch with the Taliban that there's anything we're worried about? I mean, are there pipelines or rail lines across there that we don't want shut, or somebody doesn't want shut? I mean, are there any real, other than pride, is there anything, and people, other than, what have we really lost? Anything?
I think, so Afghanistan has a significant lithium, deposits in the mountains there. My impression of the Taliban is that they are complete mercenaries. They'll sell anybody to anybody if the price is right. And so the Chinese look at Afghanistan as part of their belt and road system. And I think they will move into this area quickly, as quickly as they can, with the kind of leveraged buyout of local governments that you've seen them perform in Africa and parts of Asia. In terms of investments, I think batteries are going to get more. Lithium batteries are going to get more expensive, especially given the idea, again, driven by what I consider to be ideologues, that we have to have electric cars. So I think the price of batteries and the availability of batteries is going to become problematic. And I think if you're looking for investments in technology that are going to, move in the right direction, I would think battery technology, battery companies, because we're going to have to find some substitute for that. There's going to have to be some kind of power generation capability that and power storage capability that comes online to respond to what I think is going to be a relatively limited access to lithium.
When you say they have and had a lot of lithium, are you saying that there were a serious working mines and serious distribution where people were able to go over there and actually buy the stuff, or is it all potential?
Oh no, this is potential. This is the irony of our occupation. For as much as people talk about colonialism, we weren't there to run this. It's like the oil in Iraq. We're not getting the benefit of that. We weren't getting the benefit of the mineral resources in Afghanistan. We were just trying to stabilize the popular government, or at least stabilize it to the extent that they weren't generating terror attacks. The question is whether the Chinese or the Russians, if they go in there, will be able to exploit this. The Chinese will throw money at it, at the situation, and that may be enough. As I said, I consider the Taliban to be, and the Afghan warlord tribal system generally, to be completely mercenary. That was part of what we discovered there, is that that's why we ended up with boatloads of cash going in there.
Lou,
it was just easier to give them money.
Lou, if you had a guess, this idea that the guys folded this quickly, and Secretary of State saying that the dude was the president told him he was going to stick out to the bitter end, and he was gone like right after the phone call. How long do you think we knew in our heart of hearts that we weren't getting anywhere, and that our government that we supposedly put in place over there was the puppeteers of the world? They were like the Saigon government or worse. How long do you think we've known that?
Oh, I think we've understood that this was a losing battle, not a losing battle, but this, we were not going to fundamentally alter their mindset since at least 2014. You know, that 2014 is when we stopped really engaging in major combat operations and basically told the Afghan government that was in existence, you're going to have to fight this. We'll give you air support, but we're not putting boots on the ground anymore. I mean, you look at our casualties, they dropped off dramatically after that. And we just flew, you know, air missions in support using contractors and, in our own Air Force and Army Aviation. I think we understood that. It was a great piece by a guy named Sumatra Maitra, who I follow pretty closely. He's a London-based foreign policy expert. But he wrote a great piece that just said, if you're going to change a place like Afghanistan, you have to be prepared to, A, occupy the country, and, B, start killing people, and start killing a lot of people. You have to basically go in there with the kind of fear of God outlook that we are going to, if you cross us, we're just going to murder you. And you know, eventually you murder enough people and the population understands that resistance is going to cost them more than compliance. And this is a multi-generation process. And he said at the end of, you know, 2-3 generations of doing this, you may be able to instill your values into this culture. But absent that, and it's, you know, there's a great.
Well, we got to go. It sounds like we get
back to the Peloponnesian Wars.
Democracies
are terrible at this kind of stuff.
We got a dash, bud. But next week, let's talk a little more about that. Plus, I also want some kind of an idea of why we were so successful in South Korea. Was it because the Koreans already felt that way or whatever? Let's talk about that next week a little bit. SP Futures up 9, NASDAQ Futures up 42. Lou, have a nice weekend, buddy. Get
you
3 days
too,
off. Don't run in any coyote or any mountain lions out there rock climbing or whatever it is you do. we'll be right back. Stacks and Jacks.
This self-directed trading is a lonely job. Online trading is not as easy as point and click.
No, it's not. Everyone, even professionals, need to share ideas and think out loud every now and then.
That's what I like about PTI Pro Direct. Their staff of former option floor traders really helps me choose the right strategy for trading option volatility and plan the time decay for my covered writing program.
Yep, nothing can replace years of trading experience to stop you from making that dumb trade and for saving a few bucks. We've all been there and done that.
Yeah, I have access to all that great trading advice and experience for just a penny a share for stocks, $1 for equity options, and $1 minimum a trade.
Our clients at PTI Pro Direct can call when they need a little help on a trade or just to talk about the market in general. We trade every day. We love this stuff.
That's what I like most about PTI Pro Direct. Cheap prices along with great advice from real floor traders. It's the best of both worlds.
Tell your friends. That's PTIProDirect.com. PTIProDirect.com.
Are you one of the millions of people who suffer with pain? Do you wake up in the morning with stiffness in the lower back or neck? Why are you using medication to cover up the symptoms without treating the actual cause? Painkillers, muscle relaxants, and anti-inflammatories are not the answer. At ChiroMed, physicians are trained to detect the cause of your symptoms and to correct the underlying problem. If you're ready to listen to common sense and do what it takes to make changes in your body that can affect your health for the rest of your life, give ChiroMed a call and set up a complimentary consultation. They are located in Orland Park and can be reached at 708-403-2727. 20,000 patients over 22 years have been treated at ChiroMed, and over 90% of them have had positive results without medication or expensive surgery. Isn't it time you did something good for your body too? Give ChiroMed a call. 708-403-2727. That's 708-403-2727. Let's get you pain-free and living again.
Hear ye! The Homer Broadcasting System is on the air!
Stocks, jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control!
Right here, right now, right here, right now, right now.
Well,
Norwalk Bank Stocks and Jocks. I'm Tom Holly. Mr. Dave Scatina on the board. S&P futures up 950. NASDAQ futures up 43. But you never thought you'd be researching New York weather as much as you have been this morning.
I didn't either.
Well, that's what meteorologists do. It's not just, you know, rain over your head. It's other people's heads type of thing. Dan, how are you, buddy?
Good. How are you?
I'm doing all right. What are you, been kind of a slow week so far. You know, who knows? It's been kind of a, as you and I talked last week, there's not a whole lot of calendar trading people do anymore, but this is generally somewhat of a slow week, and now we've got New York, what are we doing? They're sweeping water into sewers this morning, so,
yeah.
So the, I guess we, the country should be happy that the thing, Hurricane Ida managed to race through, all the places on the way to New York pretty quickly, so even though it gave them a lot of rain, it didn't really stop anywhere. But it looks like New York got the worst brunt, eh?
Yeah, no question. I mean, our rain totals here in Florida are lower than average for the year. So we had a few of the bands initially, but we need rain, so it's not something people are complaining about yet.
Well,
by the end of the month or early part of October, we'll be complaining about it. But we've kind of been spared.
We've already had what is it like five named hurricanes? A couple of them went out to sea, and it's only not even Labor Day yet.
I mean, it's almost halfway through the season. I mean, September is halfway through, and that's the peak part of the season. Most of the storms have gone west of Florida, so you know most of them have gone towards. You know, the Panhandle or you know, even Texas and Louisiana, Mississippi and Alabama, that area. So we've kind of missed it. Where I live is the last major storm was Charlie, and that was 16 years ago. So, the West Coast is a lot safer, if you will, than the East Coast.
What is the status, just real quick, because I know you... you're always searching for yield. I mean, that's what you do, among other things. And a lot of the yields sometimes are in insurance companies. What is their? I know their attitude is to not pay people, but
right.
But what is the Barrier Islands to New Orleans? They claim that it's the worst they've ever been hit, and you know, like something like 40% of all houses are destroyed.
I don't think it accounted for a large number of homes, and depending on, I'm not sure about Louisiana. I know in Florida that, you know, at least where I am here, I have hurricane insurance, and it's not that expensive. It would be about four times the amount if I lived on the East Coast. When I lived on the East Coast, it was about four times the amount. But there's, you have a large premium, and I have had a couple houses hit over the years, and fortunately, one of them was a rental at the time, and it actually turned out to be a home run because I got paid a lot more than expected. I think it was Wilma, you want to have some insurance, especially if it's a single family. Condos usually have a master policy that covers, and then you just have to cover your contents. But fortunately. Like I said, it hasn't really been as big an issue here as it is, frankly, in the Northeast.
Well, when they tell the people in, like that Barrier Island, I mean, insurance companies are liable to show up and say, okay, here's your check, but if you build again, you're on your own. Is that happening in any of these areas?
Yeah, that's what will happen there, you know, in Grand Isle in Louisiana. That'll happen next. Because, they're going to have, insurance companies aren't going to touch that. But speaking of hurricane recovery, one of my thoughts, one idea that I have that I had mentioned before, several times before, and I still like this company, and they reported earnings, MasTec, MTZ, ticker symbol, and this is strictly a stock, a mid-cap stock based in Miami. I know the management team really well, top-notch management team. Their earnings, or the net income was up 33% quarter over quarter. And second quarter, their revenues were up 25%. And they have this record backlog. So their business started out doing repair work for after hurricanes. So predominantly with the electrical structure and all the stuff that you saw on the weather station about the, you know, when you saw the down power lines, that was part of their business. It still is. Now their business is branched out and they're more of an infrastructure play, and the majority of their business is repairing and maintaining cell towers. And that's a business, obviously, that will continue well into the future. They also do maintenance of oil and gas pipelines, but that's becoming a smaller part of the business. But very well-run company. Stock got as high as 122. We were buying it yesterday at 88. It's a 28% sell-off. But if you go back to March or April of 2020, it was trading less than 30. So it's, you know, I think there's been a lot of profit-taking in certain names, but this is the name that I've had a lot of confidence in for, you know, I'd say the better part of two decades. And I think, you know, if people are looking for a new idea, or if investors are looking for something that, you know, isn't continuing to hit a new high every week, this is a good alternative. This is a good, you know, a good play. And it's ironic that the day after Ida hit Louisiana, their stock price was down 3%. So, or three points, I should say.
Well, that's been the frustrating phenomenon. I mean, you know, we talked about it a couple of weeks ago, where Trump comes in office and he was going to do whatever he had to do to make sure the steel companies were back like they were in the 40s, and all he did was go straight down after he got elected. And Biden's doing the same thing for electric cars, and everything having to do with electric cars and batteries did nothing but fall the minute he got elected. I mean, this is kind of odd the way markets are reacting here. It makes it very frustrating.
I think with this, and I've had to mention this to clients quite a bit. I think people have to realize that, you know, we have talked about Thunderbird was to me another great call. I mean, we've had more than 100% increase in the stock price, and then it just gets kind of settled in. It traded off of its highs. It went up 100%, then went up another 50, and then it's come back a little. And you know, there is profit taking, and I think profit taking sometimes clouds the picture. And you know, investors who haven't been in the market for a long time or don't do this every day like us aren't aware that you just have to kind of ride it out when that's happening and look at it as a buying opportunity. So there are names, you know, despite the fact that NASDAQ is reaching new highs, and despite the fact that, you know, we're close to all-time highs pretty much across the board in U.S. equities, there are names there that have been hit that don't deserve to have been hit, and that offer a lot more value. Their valuations are not stretched at this point. So that's, you know, I think on the equity side. And the new idea that I have on the income side is a mortgage REIT. It's a ticker symbol IVR. So the other REITs that we talked about, like SELF, S-E-L-F, they're equity REITs. This is a mortgage REIT, and it's actually Invesco manages it, so it's Invesco's mortgage REIT. And there are, you know, the residential mortgage-backed securities and commercial. Dividend yield, 11.5%. Stock price, $3.13. So this is what I would refer to kind of as a steady eddy, like we talked about Chicken Soup for the Soul and SELF and BKEPP, the Blue Knight preferred. This is another name that I would add to that list that is, you know, is not going to see the same sort of volatility. I mean, their beta is something like 0.35. And that's good. I mean, if you're going to get 11.5% dividend, that's a pretty good trade-off. So, you know, the composition of the mortgages is pretty high quality, and I think there is going to continue to be a shift towards real estate as time goes on in hard assets in general, because I think a lot of people are getting somewhat nervous with the, you know, with the not knowing really what's going to happen, and I think we're going to have a better picture over the next month. But they want to get out of the, you know, some of the names that don't have earnings, that have just kept running and running, that have these high valuations, and yet they're really tempting to own. But I think in the meantime, you need to have your portfolio balanced with some of these other more value names, dividend payers, bonds, and, you know, both REITs and preferreds that I think will give you a nice hedge, you know, if we do see a sell-off. I did, you know, I had an interesting conversation with a client yesterday who has a very, very different perspective doesn't really have any experience in the investment industry, but his was talking about, you know, the cybersecurity issues, and certainly he's been probably even more so than I have been following what's going on with China and, you know, the supply chain issues and the fact that there could be some disturbance right now, and that disturbance could continue to impact the supply chain and could impact, you know, we could have cybersecurity crisis. The CEOs that I talk to frequently will say that that's their number one concern because that could hurt their business, you know, temporarily or long term. You know, if there's, you know, so that's something to be, I think, concerned about or something to be watchful of. And the other stuff we've talked about, I don't think there's any new news on, I'm not really paying attention to the jobs report this week because it's the end of the summer. I think things are going to change. I think it's going to be more significant another month. Like next month's jobs report will be more significant than this month's. Because I think people who haven't gone back to work yet decided to take August off and enjoy the summer. And now I think we're going to see, hopefully we'll see more people getting back to work. But I think some of what's going on geopolitically and, you know, I think Russia, I think China, I think the Taliban, that there could be some stuff brewing that could, you know, catch us off guard, you know, whether it's through, you know, some cyber issues or something else. And it's not the way I think every day when I'm looking at investments, but I think it's something to be aware of.
And when you say a stock like Nasdaq is, runs up and then it, the other one, Chicken Soup, or they run up and then they just kind of settle back down. I wonder, I mean, I'm asking you because you watch these stocks more than I do. It seems to me, I never watched, I was going to say the crappy stocks, but I'm going to say the best buys that were the ones that became the meme stocks and then the AMCs and the some of the new ones. One of my guys
at
one of the places calls me every day with the latest meme stock or two. It almost seems, Dan, is it guys like you and me, we are other people like you and me, it'd be a very, very sparse populated theater. That it seems like a real lot of the investing now is everything I get on my unusual option report or unusual stock report. If it's hot, I'm going to accuse a whole generation of investors, I shouldn't, but I'm going to say if it's hot, I want in. And the stuff just flares up. And nobody cares what BlackBerry did. Nobody cared what the movie theater did. Nobody ever read any. When I say nobody, a whole lot of people. All it is it's going up and it's hot and it's popping up on my screen as everybody else is buying. I'm in this momentum thing, and then all of a sudden it kind of falls out of favor,
right?
And it just kind of aimlessly kind of wanders down to some number from before, but not because anybody doesn't like it or anybody's doing the math. I don't know. It just because it's not hot anymore. What do I want that one for? And it seems like that's going on. I mean, did you catch the Zoom yesterday down about $60? I mean, for me that thing could be down 150. But I was still surprised. I would never have picked. I was actually looking at it for an earnings play, and I almost did it. But it was $1.50. It was a little above the pay grade for my guys. And just for the time spread, but the straddle was 30. So actually, the way I look at these things, that was actually a pretty darn good buy. In terms of what I try and do is buy the straddle for buy the time spread for less than 1/10 of the straddle, and this one was like 1/20, right? So in terms of my calculations, which don't always work, by the way, but I the straddle was like. $30 maybe, and the thing moves 60. You don't normally see that. But straddle is the sum of the call and the put. If you add the two together, it's essentially the market's vision of how much the stock's going to move the next day. And they oops by 100%, which is not all that normal. I was kind of surprised the size of the move. But then again, if the stock was 50, it wouldn't surprise me. They don't hardly make any money, and the revenue is nowhere near where the stock's priced. So. Are we going to see a lot of it, or what are you thinking?
Yeah, I mean, that wouldn't be something that I would, you know, because I'm more, income focused, and although it's, you know, there's there's certainly money to be made. I agree with you that the money is moving very, it moves very quickly. And because trading costs are low, and because a lot of people have been able to make money on their own because our market has been up for the last, 12, 13 years.
Oh yeah.
So it's everybody wants to be in, making their own, thinking that they've come up with the newest and greatest idea and then sort of following the trends and not necessarily losing a lot of money. So this it just continues to happen. But I think when those people, I've had a couple clients where I've told them to go ahead and follow some names that you think are the hot names because I'm not going to buy them, in your account. But set up a small account and follow them and 9 times out of 10, 10 times out of 10, they come back after a period of months and say, it just isn't working. So a lot of it is, I think, knowing when to get in and when to get out. And that's something that I think, for 35 years of doing, being a portfolio manager, that's something that you learn. You have to understand the drumbeat. The drumbeat has changed. It's definitely not as buy and hold as it has been in the past. But I'd say, if you're younger and you have a good income and you want to put some money aside and, learn be a Robin Hood trader or whatever, go for it. But, if you want to open up if you want to have an account that's going to grow, if you're a younger person, and I have a fair number of these accounts now because I have a lot of the children of clients.
Right.
And I enjoy sort of teaching them and bringing them along. And they're, the ones who really get it are the ones that are patient. And there are, there are people out there like that. So, and I think the most important thing is I think the ones who really get it are the ones that say, hey, Dan, this is what you do all day. This is what you've been doing forever. This is what you're good at. So you do it. And, don't even talk, send me your quarterly letter and keep me posted. But, unless something changes, this is what you do. So, I've always thought about, I've always thought like that because I can look at the performance I've had and know that I have, I'm buying things at institutional prices. I'm buying bonds, much cheaper than anybody is who's trading at Fidelity or other shops. We do our research. We do our homework so we can sleep easy. And I can make a phone call to a CEO to find out what's going on in the industry or at their company if something looks off. So it's, that value added pays off over time.
Well, I think it does too. It's interesting, Dan. A lot of the, some of my clients these days, I think are going to be your clients too one of these days, but last week for some reason we're meeting with a lot of the bigger ones. And it is really sort of fascinating where people, and these are, really bright people. They got a lot of dough. They were doctors, they were lawyers, whatever. But the market, I mean, right now you and I find it somewhat confusing, and you can only imagine, like I'd be in an operating room. What do I use?
Yeah.
It's really difficult because everybody brings all these, studies of who was the best guy last year and who did this last year. And the hardest part for me to say, is we can't trade last year. We have to trade this year. And we have one of the ladies that I think she was up like 29% last year in her, they call it a conviction stock thing. And she kind of sensed that these things were getting too darn high. And at the beginning of the year, she started peeling out and going to cash. And this year, some of them have come back a little, and they've come back up here and recently, like the Apples of the world and so forth, and Google, and even Amazon was down some. And she gave back like a little bit of dough. And everybody's like, well, a couple of guys were like, look at this year, look at the performance. I said, do you have any idea how impressive that is to have a really good year and to cut back dramatically? I mean, nobody's going to sell every single share on December 31st saying this game is over. But to cut way back and not lose it all as it went back down, I said, that's an impressive performance. And I said, the thing that you're buying from guys like you and me and the rest, I said, right now I would say I am so nervous on this market thing because I want to talk a little bit about these couple of trades in the VIX that I don't know if you saw or not. We kind of beat it up yesterday, so I'll be brief with it. But I said, right now, if you left to my own devices, I would take all your money and put it in my protective program. I just am nervous as hell in this market. I've got my puts tightened up. I'm seeing all kinds of stuff. People buying VIX calls. I'm seeing this happening. It just seems to me that it's sniffing like there's a change going here. The Fed is making motions like they're doing something different. I said, but if all of a sudden the market corrected 40%, and, you know, and we, you know, maybe either didn't lose or lost 5% or something, I'd be the first person to tell you that 6 months from now, you don't want to be 100% in a protected program. It's already down.
I mean, right, yeah.
You know, so I mean, I said the point is we have to be flexible, but we want to trade next quarter. We can't trade last quarter. Why do we want to go with that guy? You know, we want to,
right.
You know, so, and this, I've never seen stuff change as rapidly quarter to quarter, even week to week as it is here right now with some of these stocks and some of what's going on. I mean, I don't know if you're seeing the same thing.
Yeah, I mean, I am, and you know, my strategy has always been a little more conservative. You know, risk return. Actually, the IA, the Interactive Advisors platform, now has us as the number one risk. You know, we have a one rating, which is the most conservative that you can get. But our risk return is, I think, we're up 9% in that strategy, and it's all, you know, mostly. Fixed income or income related ETFs, and it doesn't sound like a lot, but based on, if you look at all of the risk parameters and the, you know, the value at risk and the downside and the, you know, the maximum drawdown and all that, I mean, we're better than any of the other guys. So that's a 5-year record. So when you're you know, I think this environment is good. Coming into an environment of uncertainty is good, because that's where we add value by, you know, putting names like IVR on the table, or you know, you're getting an 11.5% coupon, and those coupons do pay even if the stock kind of gets stuck in the mud. It doesn't do a whole lot, but you're getting a nice fat premium from the dividend. So that. Those are good names to have in this environment. Not necessarily your whole portfolio, but, you know, if you're, I think there's an important part of the portfolio that needs to be in fixed income and needs to be in an income oriented, needs to be in value, you know, that needs to have, you need to have some diversification. And if you do, then you can benefit on the upside from the stocks, and you can do like the person you were referring to earlier, and then you can sort of, you know, add some risk or take some risk off the table depending on how things are going and, you know, over the shorter term. But, you know, you still have to have some core positions that you believe in long term, if you're, especially when you're managing retirement money, or, you know, people are in retirement already and they're relying on those assets to live. I think it's important to have stability in your portfolio.
But you had the same issue. We also run a dividend program, one of the places I'm with, and we ran into the problem, and you mentioned it yourself, and some of the preferreds, you made so much money in a couple of months, you wouldn't buy them again at those prices. I mean, we ran into that problem with our dividend program.
Right, and that's true. I mean, but you're still getting paid. If you're getting 9%,
yes,
you know, and maybe you're now getting 8.7%, you know, that's still a really fat yield.
No, what I meant was
hard to find.
What I meant was is IVR is trading 313. If you buy it and next week it's 5, you're going to say, wait a minute, this isn't 11% anymore. What am I going to do?
Right. Yeah. Well, right.
But you're happy with that.
You'll
take 60% in 2 weeks. I mean, yeah. You know, right. But yeah, I mean, anyway, I wanted to ask you, I don't know if you've been listening to my last couple of days, because I'm kind of beating this up, because I've never really seen this before. I've seen, I get the feed for the, unusual option and, stock trading. Well, I watch the option more than I do the stock, but I've seen two very unusual, very huge trades in the VIX where people are want to get long the VIX in November. Just one of them's flat out. They bought like 90,000 calls in November. The other one was a huge diagonal where they bought the November calls and sold the October. So whoever's doing it has this very focused timing that whatever, something bad's going to happen, but not until November. And it intrigues me, Dan, because you and I, if we were to say we think the market's going up or down, probably, even if we used options, are going to say, even if I'm right, I'm not smart enough to pick the day. So yeah, I'm going to try and let's at least go to March or December or January.
You can pick the direction, but or you can pick the timing, but it's hard to pick both.
Oh, yeah. But I'm saying you and I would probably say, you know, if we thought the market was going to crap out, probably we would buy, like, some March puts in the SPY or something. You know, I mean, just give us some time. But this particular person, whoever it is, or group, is absolutely convinced that an asteroid's going to hit in November. I'm racking my brain, and all the different people that are on the show with me, even Russell Rhodes yesterday, who's written two books on the subject of VIX and knows more about VIX than, well, he's forgotten more than anybody else we know knows. And he says, I've never heard of that. Now you've gotten me intrigued, because his job used to be to explain outlying size trades to the CBOE. And he goes, I have no idea why this person thinks that November is the ticking bomb and October is going to be fine. How does anybody know that?
Well, that's what makes a market too. I know when it's a larger player and they're doing something that seems to kind of go against what you're, you know, it seems like a big bet, if you will. You sort of wonder where they're coming from, but I think one of the hardest things in this business is really not to get too, you know, not to follow the herd. If it seems like everybody else is doing something else, but nobody else is buying IBR, and IBR kind of creeps up and you get a nice dividend, I'm perfectly happy if that's what, you know, if it's suitable for my clients, that's great. So it's, there are people doing things out there, you know, individuals, who were, you know, millennial age and baby boomer age, you know, where there's a fair amount of speculation going on, and I don't think I would want to be involved with that at this late stage in the cycle. You just put a little bit of money aside, but I would not take that big a bet, or, you know, it's not at this stage. It's hard when the market is breaking new highs every day, the stock market, it's very hard to take to be very speculative. It's not hard to be speculative on a few smaller names, taking a smaller position in those names, but it's very hard in your overall portfolio to have this, to be making this bet, if you will, or taking this risk at a time when we're, you know, things are inflated and there's also, I don't know really where the, you know, what's going to cause the, you know, volatility to increase in a few months that wouldn't be causing it to increase right now. But the only thing that I think will happen, and I think it's going to take a long time for this to happen, is I think once corporate taxes, once there's more talk about corporate taxes, the corporate tax rate going up, I think that will have an impact on the equity market.
I think it will too. I have this is from my early years in the business, Dan, when the Fed was totally out of control, and, you know, trying to contract the money supply and so forth and squeeze inflation out. I still think the single biggest danger, and I hope we never get there again, is, you know, some November, December, 1.5-2% CPI numbers, to where every time one of the Fed people shows their face, people laugh at them and shoot the TV and say, who are these idiots and how'd they get us in this mess? And yeah. I think we're running a real serious danger of getting there. I really do.
Yeah, I mean, yes, I agree.
Dan, take care of yourself. Talking to you next. Have a nice weekend, buddy. Enjoy yourself. S&P futures up 9, NASDAQ futures up 42. Be right back. Stacks and Jacks.
How much confidence do you have that your investments will make you wealthy? Do you truly know the odds? Welcome to Luckbox, the control freak's guide to life, money, and probability. Luckbox shows you how to factor in the likelihood of success before you commit to an investment or any other life decision. Your brain is smarter than your gut, and that's why you owe it to yourself to read Luckbox. We've made it easy because Luckbox is free for 1 year at luckboxmagazine.com/jocks. Each new issue dives deep into the current investing climate, separates the signal from the noise with timely, actionable trading ideas, and equips you with savvy investing tactics you don't already know, all while exploring how to live your best life through music, spirits, food, sports, travel, fitness, and a whole lot more. Luckbox is the essential magazine for proactive investors who are hell-bent on controlling their financial futures. It's for overachievers and alpha types who don't buy into Wall Street's investment gurus. It's for mavericks who believe in life, luxury, and the pursuit of happiness. It's for you! Smart investors don't bet on possibilities, they play the probabilities. Luckbox is $7.99 on newsstands, but you can subscribe for 10 free digital issues at luckboxmagazine.com/jocks. Don't rely on luck, get Luckbox at luckboxmagazine.com/jocks.
Hello, this is Tom Howell, the Chief. We've talked a lot on the show about risk and suitability, about how your portfolio should match your age, income, and risk appetite. It's been hard for investors to maintain that suitability in the last several years due to a Fed strategy that has driven interest rates to virtually zero. You may have even heard that the Fed was trying to drive conservative investors to a riskier portfolio on purpose, for whatever reason. I'm sure you are aware of investors that took some increased risk, such as longer-term fixed-income securities, and are now unhappy with that choice. At PTI, we have always stressed total portfolio risk awareness and tried to minimize chasing returns in a tough environment. Well, now it looks like maybe interest rates are moving more towards historical levels. Everyone needs to be aware of what that continued movement might do to your portfolio, both good and bad. We also have a stock market that seems to have stalled, at least for the short term. I think it's time for everyone to take a serious look at their goals, their risks, and their portfolios. Do they match? If not, we can help. We have a signature protected index program. We have ways to hedge against interest risk. We can make that portfolio right for you again. Go to PTISecurities.com or call us right now. The market can change very rapidly. That's PTISecurities.com.
Hi, I'm Audrey Johnson, owner of Home Source Realty and frequent contributor to Stocks and Jocks radio show. If you're thinking about purchasing real estate, this summer could be a good time to shop around. Whether you're a novice or seasoned investor, low interest rates and good inventory make adding bricks and mortar investment to your portfolio an interesting possibility. Many a great fortune has begun with the purchase of property. Call me today for your personal investment consultation, and I would be happy to get you started on your path to prosperity. You can reach me at AudreyJohnson@Realtor.com or call me at 708-349-3456. That's 708-349-3456.
Stocks, jocks,
stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now, right here, right now, right now.
Hello and welcome back to Stacks and Jacks. I'm Tom Allen. Davis Katina on the board. S&P futures, we have them up 10 now. We just had the ADP report that came out. It was 340,000, was lowest total since March of 2020, which is somewhat interesting because, or not the ADP, the jobless claims, because the ADP was yesterday and it came in a lot lower than anybody expected on jobs gain. So if you're looking at the employment picture, there's a kind of conflicting numbers there. We have the a big number coming out from the Labor Department tomorrow. We'll have Carl on, of course, to talk about that. But it is interesting that these two are sort of in different directions here. I don't know which to believe here. But Dow is up 57 over Europe. Very slow. DAX up 5 points, call that flat. FTSE down 6 points, call that flat. CAC around up 6 points, call that flat. So kind of waffling over there. Everybody's on the beach with umbrella drinks or something, David. Maybe we should be doing that. Nikkei up 92. 0.3%, Shanghai up 29.8%. They keep, they've been strong the last couple of weeks. Hang Seng up 62.2%. Way of review last year, Dow was, Dow was down 48, S&P futures up 1, NASDAQ futures up 50. So yesterday was, up most of the day and kind of sold off along the close. Bonds 1.28 at 1.29 actually. That's minus 1 basis point. The Bund, minus 2 basis points to minus 0.39. Japan unchanged at positive 0.03. Oil, a little bit of a rally here, up 30 cents, 68.90, trying to get back to 70. Brent up 39 cents, 71.78. Natural gas down a penny at 4.60. RBOB up a penny, 2.12. We've got gold down 50 cents. Not much going on in the gold patch today. 18.15.50 is the number. Silver down 7 cents, 24.14. Copper down a penny, 4.25. And we've got Bitcoin's up 1,600, 49,942, trying to break through 50 again. What do you have for us, traffic, weather, sports?
7:37 in Chicago. Currently, the weather is 68 with some sunshine. We're going to have a high of 76 with sun and clouds. For our Phoenix listeners, it's 77 and rainy right now. They will have a high of 97 with partly cloudy skies. Traffic right now, it was a slow morning, but we do have the regular heavy buildup on the Kennedy, Eisenhower, and Stevenson due to long-term construction. Sports, baseball last night, Cubs beat the Twins 3-0. The Sox win, beating the Pirates 6-3. Diamondbacks beat Padres 8-3. FedEx Cup playoffs conclude this week with the Tour Championship at the East Lake Golf Club in Atlanta, Georgia. And a full slate of college football this weekend. Notre Dame taking on Florida State Sunday night at 6:30. Back to you, Chief.
Jen, how are you?
Tom, I'm doing fine. And you?
I'm doing all right. I, without getting into a any a debate over, last thing I want to do is get into a debate over abortion rights. I saw the Supreme Court decision, 5-4, allowing this Texas law to go through. Didn't they pretty much just repeal Roe versus Wade, or what am I missing?
Well, they certainly left the door open. It's an unsigned opinion, I think. But you know what it's really going to do, Tom, is increase all the yells from the left for Stephen Breyer to resign and to replace that seat while there's a Democrat in the White House, and get somebody in there who is likely to stay a while and be a certain vote for upholding Roe v. Wade. But, you know, it's kind of the uncomfortable, and maybe it's the inevitable result of what's happened. The decision was a great upheaval in 73, Roe v. Wade, polarized the country. But it wasn't really until, over the next 20 or 30 years that it became a political football, such that the Democrats kind of evicted anybody from the party who wasn't on board with abortion on demand. And you saw a lot of party switching over this, and you still see a lot of people who can't find a home in the Democratic Party if they're pro-life in any sense. So it's become, unfortunately, now a totally politicized thing along party lines, and that, I guess, was inevitable. I don't see any way of avoiding it, really, the way things were done, but it's likely to become increasingly important in the next several presidential election cycles.
Well, explain this to me, though, Mr. Attorney. You happen to be the attorney of the day here. The law, which went into effect after midnight, this is from CNBC, which went into effect after midnight in Texas on Wednesday, bars most abortions after as early as 6 weeks of pregnancy and allows private citizens to file civil lawsuits against abortion providers. What does that mean? Why, if I know somebody gave somebody an abortion, why would I be able to sue? What's my harm? How did that harm me? How should I get paid?
Well, I haven't read the legislation. I wonder if it has to do with familial relationships. If a spouse finds out that a spouse had an abortion, that they have a cause of action against the abortionist. I don't know if it goes as far as reporting your neighbor or something like that. I suspect it's within a family or a spousal relationship or an intimate relationship of some kind. I think a lot of this, and, you know, this is what's really never stopped with the Roe v. Wade decision. There have always been action groups pumping up to push back on this, and I think it's always been crafted in a way to see what kind of response you get from the judiciary, and, you know, this will always be the case when you don't have complete agreement on the subject, that it becomes a political football, and then, you know, it's first a judicial football, and you got legislation being crafted to dodge certain bullets and maybe create other situations that become fodder for the next cycle. So
if you're a Texas lady that wants one, you got to go to Oklahoma, basically.
Right. You know, that's the situation you and I grew up with, being from Illinois, when it was illegal here, but it was legal in New York and other places. And there was, you know, a whole industry in moving people around to get the benefit of a legal abortion when one wasn't offered close to home. And it had been that way for quite a while. And, it's just one of the things, the more things change, the more they stay the same. We're probably right back where we started on this whole issue hundreds of years ago in this country and farther back in history elsewhere. That it's a controversial decision, best left to the people involved in it. But it's got such a moral tinge to it and a religious importance attached to it that it isn't going to go down easily for either side, no matter what happens. So it's always going to be a source of controversy and hatred and everything else.
Well, it sure seems like it. I mean, I don't know. I think the, my own personal position, not that anybody cares, is I'm pretty much very much against somebody getting an abortion, and I would love to be a president or someplace that figures out a way to make it so there were an awful lot less of them on my watch. But as to whether or not it should be a law and with penalties, and I don't know that it needs to be a secular issue on that level. I mean, I would. So where does that put me? I'm saying I would not encourage somebody to do it. I'd try and find a way around it. But that doesn't mean I think somebody should go. It should be a law that you can't get one done if you want one. I mean, where does that put me? Nuts?
No, and your question, the problem really now is more one of funding. Is this something that the, you know, the public can expect the public to pay for, so that your tax dollars go to this, and then we have the Hyde Amendment and barriers against that? I think most people I talk to, you know, leave it to the decision of the people involved and prefer that the law not get involved with it at all. Of course, that's a nice position to take, but it's a utopian position,
well,
too.
Sure.
It's because you can't really separate them. But I do think that there's a tipping point in all of this where you will see, you know, be careful of what you wish for, because if you have abortion on demand, it's kind of a slippery slope until you get mandated abortions. Because if the stigma is taken away that this is just a surgical procedure, there's no moral consequences, then it's easy for somebody to insist that you get one. And this is what's happened in China, of course.
Yeah, oh yeah.
And nobody wants that, I would think.
But yeah, but there was only...
Isn't the biggest step, really.
Yeah, but they were only worried about getting rid of the girl babies.
Right, and now they've completely screwed up their demographics.
Yeah, oh yeah.
So, you know, I mean, they now have an aging population such that, you know, they've got worse problems than we can even imagine. When
yeah,
comes
that,
to
that really was a
screw-up here.
It was just yet another screw-up on their part. But, I'm running into this issue on all kinds of fronts here, Jan, and that somehow or another we're teaching young people, and I don't know if it's because, well, you and I had the odd upbringing, you know, the Catholic schools and the whole bit, where the nun pretty much let you know pretty strictly what was right and wrong, and I'm not so sure they were wrong about that. I don't think they were. And, you know, your parents were kind of in lockstep. Not everybody, but most everybody. Somehow or another, it seems like we're getting this routine where we keep looking for government for everything, including our morals. I mean, I don't necessarily need an anti-abortion law for me to try and help somebody to find another way to not get an abortion. There can be a huge difference between legal and moral on just about everything. I mean, take the taxes overseas. I thought they were spectacularly immoral. And people found a way to pay off IRS people or congressmen or whatever to make it so that they didn't pay taxes and other people did. I think it sucked. And I think we should have those people today. But now, was it legal? I mean, could I prosecute the person? I don't know. I might want to go, you know, grab him and put him in the village square and throw tomatoes at him. But I don't know that it was if some lawyer wound his way through various IRS decisions, was it? I'll say this: it probably wasn't legal, but it wasn't illegal. How's that even for a more stupid term?
Yep.
But I mean, this idea that as long as it's legal, I can do it. No, I mean, if we fall down that rat hole as a country, I think we got real problems, because I mean, what did we learn in school that if society, the church, everybody, a family, can deal with somebody being a immoral lawbreaker, if it's one tenth to 1% of the population, if all of a sudden everybody steals, everybody sells drugs, everybody drives 100 miles an hour, you got a problem. You know, and I think we're sort of getting there, because people, what do you mean, it's not illegal? What's the problem? There's no law against it. Well, wait a minute.
Well, Tom, you've given me an opportunity for a shout-out to one of my 8th grade nun teachers, Sister Marciana. She's from Chicago, but she was a member of the Detroit, you know, area related order of nuns.
What grammar school were you?
Servants.
What grammar school were you?
St. Felicitas over in Avalon Park.
Where the hell is that?
84th and Blackstone.
Oh, yeah.
But Sister Marciana in my 8th grade, I mean, it was sort of prefatory to a sex education drill that the nuns were giving to the girls.
Oh, God.
And that the priests were going to give to the guys. But this is before this course had actually started. And she spoke to everybody in the class. And I remember her saying, you know, the one thing you have that nobody can take away from you is your conscience. And if you are asked to do something bad, that you know is bad, I don't care if it's a priest telling you to do it. You don't do it. Your conscience is more important than anybody, than me giving you an order. If you think deep down it's wrong, then don't do it. Always listen to your conscience. Take care of your conscience. Cultivate it. Make it the most important thing you have, and it will keep you safe from the worst things that can happen to you. But once you lose that, you are lost. And I remember it was, in retrospect, it was a way of saying, well, even in the case of an abuse situation with a priest, if a priest tells you to do something and it's wrong to you, you don't do it. And maybe she knew more than she was letting on. But now we don't have consciences anymore, Tom. We're not expected to cultivate them. We expect the government to tell us what to do, and it acts in our best interest always, of course.
Oh, yeah.
So we don't have any moral struggles anymore. We let somebody else decide for us, and we just blithely go along and surrender the last bastion we have against really doing stupid stuff that we should know better enough not to do. But we've decided it's not important to wrestle with those things. We're too lazy to wrestle with it.
My grandmother was an immigrant from Italy. And she would say that a well-brought-up child should have a serious knowledge of right and wrong by the time they're seven.
Well, and that's, when they decided you could have First Communion
yep.
at that age, because it had been much, you had to be 12 or 13, I think, until my mother's generation. And that was, you should have a sense of that when you're seven.
By the way, you should be able to watch your parents and what they do and don't do,
right.
And when a decision, to drive 100 miles an hour shows up, if you did that in one of those 50 cars, you'd be doing some interesting stuff. But and you say, no, I'm not going to do that, and here's why, and they talk about it, and you listen to them talk, you realize that you should know that if everybody acted like that, we would have a problem by the time that it's that age. I think we sort of don't, I don't know, we think these kids, I mean, some of these kids are 13 running around carrying guns for guys that are 15, and we're saying, well, they're juveniles. They're juveniles, but you should know by the time you're 13 you're not supposed to carry guns for other people.
Yeah, it's no excuse in my book.
No, are you more easily influenced when you're 13 by the 18-year-old you think is cool? Well, yeah. But being cool and wearing your sleeves rolled up like that guy does because you want to look cool is a lot different than carrying a gun for him. Yeah, you would think, right?
Yeah. Well, and if you've raised generations of kids where you've been asleep at the switch, if you're a parent or there's no real family structure at all, there's no way to develop a conscience. There's no way to develop an independent sense of what I should do or shouldn't do in situation A, B, C, whatever. So it isn't that surprising that we end up with such horrible decisions that are being made and with a lack of any kind of sense of the consequences for ourselves or for the other people that we harm or take no notice of. That's the bigger issue in my book than gun control or, throwing money at schools or anything like that. Money doesn't build a conscience. If anything, it erodes it. But
well, Jan, it's one of the reasons why some of the stuff that we talk about on this show, and based on my experience in the last inflation fiasco, in the last Federal Reserve Board total screw up fiasco, well, not the last one, we did Y2K, but there's been a few along the way, but let's say the performance from 68 to 75 was probably as bad as we've ever had. Where's Milton Friedman when I need him? I'm sure he could say that the first bank of the United States screwed up worse than, in 1880 or someplace. But barring that, I don't really get. I'm having trouble, Jan, as you know, you talk to me twice a week, having trouble figuring out if these people, when they see they're going to drop an inflation rate of 5, 6, 8%, 10% on people, For the foreseeable future. Now they're saying it's going to stop next year, and maybe they really believe that. And if they do, I guess I'll back off a little bit. But if they really believe, but they must know that for people who, and I'm not talking about the guy who was making 10, and now Walgreens says they're going to pay him 15, right? That's a reasonable jump. But the person who was making 15 before is probably not getting a raise at all. If he is, he's going to 16 or 17. But if we start talking about 5, 8, 10% inflation for a year, and looking back over the last 20 years and where these salaries have gone to, if you start dropping 2 years in a row of 10% inflation on people that really haven't had much of a raise in 20 years and now might get, a 5% raise or something, if you have any concept of numbers, and I have to believe as dumb as some of them sound on TV, and I would never accuse them of being dumb, but as dumb as some of them sound on TV, these Fed board members and people like that, and these central bank presidents from the various areas, they sound like they don't own a calculator, Trent. I mean, because if you actually put that down there and say, okay, let me get this straight. This person has had a 20% raise since 2000, and the inflation that we count is up 55%. Well, they're clearly already behind. And now we're talking about dropping 8 to 10 on this over the next at least couple years, even if we think it's going to come back down. By the way, the price of used cars are up 50% in like 12 months or 40%, and they're never going to really come back down. We're just not going to say they're going up again. How exactly do you not realize that you are eviscerating these people? You know, whether it's either denial or you don't care, and I can't figure out what it is, Jan, whether they can be possibly that. I won't say dumb, because they're not dumb. Insulated, where they don't see what I'm seeing or don't have the history to see how it happened before and how uneven this goes. How do they, or they do know, and they say, those people, they're not employing me. The banks are, and the big companies are employing me, and the big shots that have power. I'm their stooge, not the general population. Now, which do you think it is?
Well, I think they've been desensitized in the same way that gangbangers have been desensitized, and you get K Street lobbyists and, you know, interest groups and big money donors that take advantage of people that don't have a spine. And, you know, the only people now who can get elected to a senator's position or really any, you know, congressional post has to have zero spine, because there's no way you could withhold the assault that are being made on you from various interest groups. Pitch this, vote on this, sponsor this, whatever else, don't vote for that. All this stuff requires people who have lost their ability to make reasoned moral decisions for themselves, let alone anybody else. And it's all about following instructions and following orders. So you have a political class now that has surrendered its thinking power and its ability to discriminate right from wrong, even, to interest groups that have decided we're more important than you, and as long as we take care of you and you're happy, you'll never have to worry about money, certainly, and you'll have a good life, and we'll give you lots of perks. And look the other way if you see any, you know, problem with this kind of arrangement. So you can, from top to bottom, you can see it all the way through the political system. Now they've been selected because they don't have spines. So
right.
When you get people with no spines, you also have people who really have no brains or moral compass either.
Well,
surprising we get these ridiculous, you know, blatherings, you know, in the press all the time, people pontificating about stuff they know nothing about and ramming it down the throats of people who expected these people to represent their interests and not somebody else's. So.
Well, John, do you think that the reason why we get the candidates we do, you know, that's a broad statement, but, and I'm not saying that, I honestly do think that in some of these areas, like in the state legislatures and places like that, in some of these states where, I mean, the lady who was a state senator from Portage, I mean, I don't know her very well. I've talked to her a few times. Some of Audrey's friends know her very well because she lives, you know, she had a place in Ogden Dunes. And she is as straight America as you can find, Jan. But she's also never going to run for president or anything. She's, you know, a little older. She's short. I mean, it's like, of course, not that, what's her name, Janet Yellen, sure, but I'm saying, how can I say this? She's no threat to the status quo, right? But she's a solid legislator. She actually gives a crap. She's there. She goes through the budget. She wants a balanced budget. I mean, she's a regular person that is in the state legislature in Indiana. And I honestly believe that there's a real lot of those people around. They just can't seem to percolate up because somebody's there. And I think that the people don't. I'm starting to believe, Jan, as I get older, I think those people are afraid, because I think we've seen people taken out. I mean, I think Gary Hart was taken out of the system. I think it wasn't just the reporters that found him. I think Elliot's was it Spitzer? He was taken out. He was a serious danger to the status quo after what he did to the New York Stock Exchange specialists and some of the people, and telling the people in the SEC all they did were they had their nose up the behind of the people in the New York Stock Exchange and the big firms. He said a lot of things that pissed a lot of people off. and he was taken out. I mean, I think the guy who ran against Obama for the Senate here in Illinois was taken out. The guy that went to the sex club with his wife in Europe. So
yeah,
what?
Brian.
Yeah, so what? If I was married, if I couldn't go with my wife and see what other people are doing to see if it might be fun, who cares? Am I going to do that every day? No, I'm a pretty moral, straight guy. But
well,
still,
remember how that unfolded, too, Todd, yeah. That it was the Republican newspaper that back then was the Republican newspaper, the Chicago Tribune, that sued to get Ryan's divorce papers unlocked so that that news could be shared. I mean, what business did the Tribune have in this other than to humiliate somebody that you know, the favorite son Obama was going to run against? So you had the powerful undoing, you know, the not so bad people, but it became impossible for Ryan to stay in that campaign.
I would have said that out of 100 people going to the sex club with a member of the opposite sex, he's probably the only one that took his wife.
And you talk to how many of the senators do you think today would want to admit to their sexual peccadillo in the past?
I'm going to say that I don't think for a second that Epstein killed himself.
But Gary Hart thing, Lee Atwater, you know, admitted not too long before he died that he set that whole thing up with Gary Hart for the photo op. It was engineered to have the picture taken in that compromising situation on the boat, and then to blast the picture all over the place, and to get, you know, Hart to resign in shame from the campaign. So none of this stuff is accidental, and you can get even darker stories like Paul Wellstone's mysterious plane crash. You know, and they got Norm Coleman as his replacement.
Well, we got a dash jam, but we can do this for. But I think a lot of people that we might want to see in these offices are afraid. I really do. SP Futures up 12, NASDAQ Futures up 46. John, who knows? Maybe I'll see you this weekend or before.
I hope so, Tom.
Yeah, we'll get together. Of course, John's one of these guys. He says he'll see you tomorrow night, and then he's like in Iowa tomorrow or something. Anyway, take care, buddy. Back tomorrow, Stocks and Jocks.
What do we learn, Palmer?
I don't know, sir.
I don't know either. I guess we learned not to do it again.
Stocks and Jocks is brought to you by PTI Securities and Futures. Go to PTISecurities.com. PTI Pro Direct. Trade for as low as a penny per share and a dollar per option contract. Learn more at PTIProDirect.com. Nadex, offering an intuitive way to trade the financial markets. Visit Nadex.com. Home Source Realty. Call Audrey Johnson at 708-349-3456. Hamzy Analytics. Listen to Fari Hamzy every other Thursday and visit HamzyAnalytics.com. ChiroMed. Back or neck pain? Schedule a complimentary consultation by calling 708-403-2727. Dax Research. Tune in for David Andelman's technical analysis on Mondays and Thursdays and call 1-800-821-4968.